So please pass it around. Okay, so these are lectures on ekparotic and cyclic cosmology. Let me give you just a brief plan of the lectures. So the first lecture will deal with the ekparotic phase. The second and third lectures are going to be about cosmological perturbations. Now, to some extent, all of this stuff is clearer from a higher dimensional point of view when you start to embed this in string theory. So, but it's easier to present the physics first from a standard four-dimensional point of view. So I'll leave this higher dimensional interpretation to the fourth lecture. But the higher dimensional interpretation has the advantage of giving you sort of a geometric picture and a more intuitive picture of what's going on. And the last lecture will be about cyclic universes. Okay. So, by means of introduction, it's helpful to look at an earlier version of a cyclic universe. This is the oscillatory model that was very popular for several decades during the 20th century, and which tried to make sense out of some of the discoveries that were made then. This model has since been ruled out, and it's important to understand why it has been ruled out and how these new models evade all these problems. So first, let me just say that in the 20th century, there were two really astonishing discoveries in cosmology, right? So, and each led to, at the same time, led to a really big puzzle. So in the 1920s, we had the discovery of the expansion of the universe, which immediately led to the puzzle of the Big Bang. Now, the Big Bang is completely, you know, unaddressed in the standard cosmological framework. So the question is there a chance that we can find out what happened at the Big Bang? And in fact, was the Big Bang really the beginning of time, as some people thought the expansion of the universe seemed to imply? Of course, what the equations of general relativity really imply is that the Big Bang is a singularity, but that just means that the equations break down. So we know that we need better equations. Of course, there's clearly the possibility that the Big Bang was not the beginning of time, and that's the point of view that I'm going to take here in these lectures. The second really astonishing discovery was the acceleration of the universe in the 1990s. And, of course, this is the dark energy problem. There is absolutely no reason for dark energy in the standard cosmological framework. So it has no function. So clearly it must be telling us something. I mean, to just have it as an addition with no rationale for it is just appears strange. So as we'll see in these cyclic universes that I'm going to talk about here, dark energy plays a very fundamental role and not only is it allowed in the model, but it's actually a requirement of the model. So in some sense, these two big discoveries can be taken as sort of guiding mysteries. I mean, these are the things that we really want to understand. So in order to address the first of these mysteries, many people adopted the oscillating universe model. This was a popular model in the middle of the 20th century. And it had the matter density was assumed to be higher than critical. So omega matter was bigger than the critical density. In such a universe, the scale factor expands up to a maximum value and then recontracts. So we would now be living in the expanding phase, and at some point, the expansion slows down, comes to a halt, and the universe recollapses. The main attraction of this model was, this was considered by many people, by Lemaître, by Einstein, and so many people considered this to be the most appealing model of cosmology. Of course, the observations were less good at the time, so this was still allowed by observations. Now, the appeal was that since this model recollapses to very high density state, people thought that it would be quite likely that from this very high density state, the universe could re-expand, right, so as to actually make a cyclic model. This has the advantage that then you don't have to worry about initial conditions because each cycle sets up the initial conditions for the next cycle. So there were several advantages to this model. So let's say the bounce was considered an advantage since it takes care of initial conditions. Or so it was thought. Yes.
I still have to give conditions somewhere. They might not be initial, and you might be able to propagate that switching backwards and forwards in time.
Of course.
But I have to tell you something. I can't just say, what is the motion of any harmonic oscillator? So how do you...
Yes, I agree. That's why I say it was thought it would take care of initial conditions. I don't think it does, but... But at least it gives you, it means you don't have to start at the Big Bang. You can say that instead of, it takes care of, it doesn't require a beginning of time, which is a very strange concept. Another advantage is that the overdensity of matter implies that the spatial sections in this universe are finite. So this universe has finite volume. Many people thought that was an attractive feature since you don't have to deal with infinities. And then there were ideas, for example, John Wheeler had the idea that constants of nature could change at each of these big bangs. And so that one would get sort of a natural selection for the constants of nature. And this would then at least give you a framework in which you could perhaps understand why alpha is 1 over 137, things like this. Now, of course, now we know that this model is completely ruled out for observations. So this model has actually lots of problems. First of all, it gives the age of the universe is too short. So typically, it's only these models give an age of the universe of 9 billion years, which is less than the age of the older stars. We now know that observations tell us that omega matter is clearly less than the critical density. There's no dark energy in this model. So it's very blatantly ruled out by current observations. But there are also more subtle problems. And one of these is the entropy problem. Right? So the Tolman pointed out that you should be producing entropy at each site. The entropy should always increase. Now, it turns out that the entropy, the amount of entropy is related to the length, the duration of one of these cycles. So what you find out is that this picture is actually wrong. That what you should have instead is you have your cycle here, but the next one should be bigger. At the same time, this means that the previous cycles must have been shorter. And you're back to your original problem of having a beginning of time. So in the end, this model didn't solve anything. But it's important to keep in mind that, I mean, you should keep all these problems in mind in, this, in order to see how these more recent models can evade all of these. Yeah.
Is there an easy way of seeing why this small universe is that high entropy? I'm used to thinking of collapses happening quickly on generically for normal initial conditions. We expect the time scale of the universe to be n prime. We have to tune a lot to get long lived universes. But high tuning means small volume and phase space, which would suggest FIW like universes are low entropy rather than high entropy.
So these are the small entropy ones.
Right, that's what I'm saying I don't understand.
Oh, it turns out that the entropy is actually related to the temperature, the minimum temperature that you achieve. And the small ones have a higher minimum temperature, and the long ones have a lower minimum temperature. It's just because the universe expands. If it expands more, it becomes colder, and this will correspond to a larger entropy. Okay, so those are. This is just as an introduction, you know, something to keep in mind. I gave you a handout which contains some basic formulae of general relativistic cosmology, because I didn't want to write them all on the blackboard. So this is material that I assume you're all familiar with, but I thought I'll just distribute it so that, because, I mean, it helps to set up a notation and just give background information. So section A is just gives you an overview of the equation of motion that you have in the universe, where you have gravity and scalar fields. I don't know if the handout went all the way. Okay. If there's not enough, then I can print out some more for next time. So the only important thing in this first section is that if you have a matter component in the universe with equation of state W, where W is the ratio of the pressure to the energy density, then this component, you can solve the its equation of motion, and you find that the energy density scales as scales as scale factor to the power minus 3 times 1 plus W. Okay, this is a relation that we'll use many times. So, for example, for pressureless matter, W is zero, and rho just dilutes as the volume in space-time. For radiation, W is a third, rho is a 8 to the minus 4. And if you have something like a cosmological constant, W is equal to minus 1, and so its energy density is constant.
So yeah, basically, reversible process is not possible.
I'm sorry?
Reversible process. Entropy is constant. I mean, you said as time goes by, entropy should increase.
The entropy should increase, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So
that's the second law of thermodynamics.
I mean, kind of, if I think about it, the universe is some kind of isolated system. That has a reversible.
No, this is not a reversible process because you have matter is just continuously. I mean, in a sense, this is you have gravitational energy that's converted into matter, and you can't necessarily convert it back. Okay, so. The section B on this handout is just a summary of the standard cosmological puzzles. This is just, I think you've already, some of the lecturers have already talked about this in the previous lectures. The universe, you can express, if you define omega to be the total energy density, the ratio of the total energy density to the critical energy density, then we know from current measurements that this is the energy density in all the matter components in the universe. We know you can then write that omega minus 1 is just given by the curvature of the universe over AA. And we know from present measurements, this is less than about 10 to the minus 2. So if you extrapolate this back in time, to very early times, you find that the curvature, the energy density of the curvature in the universe must have been extremely small at initial times. So at the prime time, it would be less than 10 to the minus 62 or so. So this is clearly a very special state to start the universe off. So, and it asks for an explanation. The horizon problem is that different regions of the CMB have approximately the same temperature. But again, if you go back towards the Big Bang, you find out that regions in different directions of the sky couldn't have been in causal contact in the standard cosmological framework. And so there seems to be a problem with causality, because the fact that they have the same temperature indicates that they at some point, they were in thermal equilibrium with each other. There's the monopole problem, which is that if you have grand unification at high energies, then starting from a very high energy state in the initial universe, you expect to have phase transitions, and you expect to form topological defects. Now, these, one should still be able to see these, but there aren't any seen. This might, of course, just be a problem for particle physics in the sense that there might never have been grand unification, then you don't have this problem. And then the problem is that, on the one hand, the universe is extremely flat, but it's not exactly flat. You have small inhomogeneities at the level of delta rho over rho of 10 to the minus 5 in the CMB. So we don't just have to understand why the universe was extremely flat, but also why it wasn't just exactly flat, why it was very nearly not flat. So these are the standard puzzles that that every theory of the early universe has to address. So one, you'll hear in the lectures on inflation, you'll hear about the most commonly assumed solution to these problems, which is an inflationary phase, which is a phase of extremely fast acceleration. Before the standard, extremely accelerated expansion, just before the standard expansion phase of the universe. Here, I'm going to talk about a completely different solution to all these problems. Okay, so it goes by the name of the ekparotic phase. So this is a slowly contracting phase. That's assumed to precede the standard expanding phase. Its main distinguishing feature is that it has an equation of state W much greater than 1. In a moment, we'll see that this condition is the same condition as having a slowly contracting phase, in fact. And it solves the standard cosmological posits. And how it does that, we'll see that in a minute. So the easiest way to model this is to use gravity plus a scalar field with a potential. Okay, so the action is the integral over the determinant, square root of the determinant of the metric. And then a canonically normalized scalar field and a potential. Now, if we have such a theory, then the equation of state is the pressure divided by the energy density of the scalar field. And if we neglect spatial gradients, so we only consider phi to depend on time for now, then this is given by half phi dot squared minus v over a half phi dot squared plus v. So now, for the sake of argument, assume a potential which is negative and steep. Okay, so here's phi, here's the potential v of phi, and we assume a potential that falls off sharply. Okay, so one possible way to model this is to take v to be given by minus v1 e to the minus c phi, where c is some constant. The value of V1 is actually unimportant because you can shift the definition of phi, and then this will just shift the value of V1. Now, what you can see immediately is that if V is negative, this term is bigger than this term. The pressure is bigger than the energy density. So immediately, you have W greater than 1. So now if we assume that C is large, then the equations of motion, the Einstein equations, are solved approximately by the following scaling solution. So the scale factor A goes as minus t to the 1 over epsilon. The scalar field goes as the square root of 2 over epsilon log And here, epsilon is related directly to the constant c. So epsilon is c squared over 2. And this is also directly related to the equation of state, 3 half 1 plus w.
Did you take phi dot to be large? I mean,
what's that?
Did you take phi dot to be large? I mean, why is the denominator not negative? Mm-hmm. Or w is half of phi dot square minus v over half of phi dot square plus v. So,
when the denominator is negative, then omega should be less than.
Oh, well, this just doesn't, if you start with standard initial conditions, this doesn't happen. Then rho is always positive. In fact, in this solution, you can easily verify that
rho is conserved, right? There's nothing to this one. I mean, you're ignoring any background gravity. It's just a scalar field in the potential.
Yes, and gravity.
And gravity. Is rho conserved?
No, rho evolves as 1 over t squared, in fact.
Oh, I see, because of.
But b, the phi dot is large because b is negative, so rho should be positive phi dot squared.
Right. But the point is, yeah, but rho is always positive. So, I mean, the thing is that as you start rolling, as V becomes more negative, of course, you start rolling faster and faster because the potential is very steep. So, and this compensates for the fact that V becomes negative. So, I'm using coordinates, time coordinates here where T is negative and runs from large negative values up to zero. T zero corresponds to phi going off to minus infinity. And you can see that if C is large, epsilon is large, and then the universe contracts very slowly. This goes as time to the 1 over epsilon, which is a very small power. So actually, the scale factor is almost constant, just your universe contracts extremely slowly.
Yes? Isn't C dimensional? The dimensions of 1 over pi, which
would sit at the bond of 1. Oh, I'm using natural units everywhere, where h bar c and then Planck are 1. I guess you can write this as phi and Planck. So, it's useful to generalize this to several scalar fields just for later use. Right, so if you have several scalars, let's call them phi I. I runs over the number of scalar fields you have. And if you assume that each of them, that the potential is given as the sum example, each of them has an ekbarotic potential, then if all these ci are large, then this scaling solution becomes a is minus t to the 1 over epsilon. That doesn't change, and then each of the scalar fields is given by 2 over ci. There's no summation over I involved here. Okay, and then in this case, 1 over epsilon is given by the sum of 2 over ci squared. This is the sum of I. And in this case, well, and then it's easy to verify that V, in fact, is given approximately by minus 1 over epsilon p squared. This is a useful relation that we'll use several times. So the reason why this is called a scaling solution is because if you look at the Friedmann equation, each term scales in the same way with time. So you have the Friedmann equation, which is mu h squared is rho plus v, and then each term goes as 1 over t squared. So the ratios of the terms, one with respect to the other, stay constant. So how does this solve the flatness problem? Well, if we have if we look at the full Friedmann equation, and include other types of matter, so we have n curvature. Curvature term scales as 1 over a squared, then there's ordinary matter, which scales as 1 over the volume, you know, radiation is 1 over a to the 4. Anisotropies in the curvature scale is 1 over a to the 6. You can have other types of matter, and then we have the ekparotic matter, which scales as a to the 3 times 1 plus w. So another way to consider the flatness problem is to say that the energy density stored in the curvature must have been extremely small at early times. Now, if you have a contracting universe, you see that terms which have higher negative powers, we scale with higher negative powers of the scale factor, come to dominate one after the other. So A goes to 0, and then, of course, these terms start blowing up faster and faster. So normally, you would expect that the anisotropy term would quickly dominate. And in fact, this is what's usually referred to as sort of a chaotic mixmaster crunch. You have certain directions that become extremely curved, and then others become extremely curved, and the whole thing is a chaotic mess. This is because if this is the highest power you have, then that's inevitable, right? You just get a very chaotic crunch, and then you can't expect to be able to predict anything coming out of this. In fact, this was another problem with the oscillating model. However, in this case, we have W greater than 1, or even much greater than 1. So that means that the ekparotic term comes to dominate eventually. So for example, you can define omega k, the relative energy density stored in the curvature, by just you can divide this equation out by 3h squared. Or the relative energy density stored in the anisotropies as sigma squared over 3a squared, a to the 6h squared. So during the ekparotic phase, from up here we have that A goes as minus t to the 1 over epsilon, which means that h goes as 1 over epsilon t. So this A is roughly constant because epsilon is a large number. And H, say H is negative because the universe is contracting, but if you take mod H, then as T goes to zero, this grows very fast. Okay, so A is roughly constant, H grows by a huge amount. That means that omega K is driven towards zero. Omega sigma is also driven towards zero. So the energy stored in the curvature, in the anisotropies of the curvature, become completely negligible by the end of this ekbarotic phase. And so you end up with a very flat and isotropic universe. In fact, the requirement for how long the ekbarotic phase has to last is you're going to work it out in one of the exercises, if you want. There are no BKL oscillations. No, they are completely suppressed. So in fact, one way to interpret this is to say that because this potential is so steep and negative, in fact, you're converting gravitational energy into the energy of the scalar field. Because normally, if you have normal matter and you just compress it, you would expect it, of course, to just scale as 1 over the volume. But this ekbarotic matter scales much faster. So you're converting huge amounts of gravitational energy into the scalar field energy. Yes? Well, it turns out that if you have a single scalar field, this is actually stable because there's no other direction to go in. But it turns out if you have more than one scalar field, then it is unstable. And this is something that I'm going to talk about later on. In fact, this is going to be one of the main topics of the last lecture. But I mean, this is very important. But the single scalar case is actually not unstable. Well, in the sense that you have to stop at some point. You shouldn't, this ekbarotic phase shouldn't last. I mean, the potential shouldn't go off down to minus infinity. At some point, the potential should bottom out. And in fact, if the potential, if at some point the potential goes to a constant or goes back up to zero, something like that, if it stops decreasing, then it quickly becomes unimportant. Right, so the second problem is the horizon puzzle. So this is the problem that different regions you observe in the sky appear not to have been in causal contact since the Big Bang. Of course, here, there is no horizon problem. I mean, what horizon problem? There was plenty of time before the Big Bang for all these regions to be in causal contact, so this problem just doesn't arise. The monopole problem, in fact, the monopole problem only arises if you require the energy density to be extremely high in the early universe, above the grand unified scale. If the reversal from contraction to expansion occurs at an energy scale below the grand unified scale, then you never produce any topological defects. So this is so there is no monopole problem as long as the time at the bounds, say, sorry, as long as the temperature at the bounds is less than the grand unified scale. And this turns out to be quite a natural requirement in these models. We'll see that in more detail later. Now, the inhomogeneity problem that to look at this in detail requires substantially more work. Okay, so this is lectures 2 and 3. But it will also be solved. It's just that to work out the whole theory of cosmological perturbations and to quantize these and so is just a bit of calculation, computational effort. Right? So we'll go through this in detail in the next couple of lectures. Actually, just to contrast with how inflation works, one can use a very similar argument to see why inflation also solves the flatness problem. So if you look at the Friedman equation, but in inflation, you have something like a cosmological constant at very early times, and the universe is expanding. So you have something which is where W is roughly minus 1, so that you have a term which is constant in this equation. Right? So let's say plus you have rho inflation. But this is, doesn't scale with A. But now the universe is expanding. So if the universe is expanding, you go the other way. All these terms become less and less important. And terms which scale with a smaller power, smaller negative power of A, start to dominate progressively. And so quickly, the inflationary energy comes to dominate. And in this case, H is roughly constant and A grows by a very large amount. So here we had A constant and H growing. For inflation, you have it the other way around. H is constant, A is growing. And again, these relative energy densities quickly go to zero. So it's actually, in some sense, it's kind of a dual picture of inflation. So the question is, how does this fit into a more complete cosmological picture? And in fact, the last lecture will be mainly devoted to cyclic universes and how one can try and make a complete cosmological theory out of this. But I'll just, to give you an idea, I'll just, you know, give you a sort of a short version now, just so that it's perhaps useful to keep in mind the big picture. So okay, so in the cyclic picture, you assume that the potential has additional features. And so it's sort of an extension of this ekpyrotic potential. The standard ekpyrotic potential we just looked at so far would be this region here. And then, as I said before, the potential can't keep going up to all the way to minus infinity. And in fact, in string theory, you don't expect this to happen. This is something also we'll see later in a later lecture, but it turns out that typically, if you try to go close to the big crunch, the coupling constant of string theory tends to become small, and this tends to turn off all potentials. So what you naturally expect to happen is that as phi goes to minus infinity, the potential should come back up to zero. And then here, the idea is that the potential for large phi goes over to a positive value V naught corresponding to the present day cosmological constant. So anyway, since the picture is cyclic, I can pretty much start in any point of this evolution. But let's start with the ekprotic phase that we just talked about. So the idea is that you have a slowly contracting phase of the universe. At some point, the ekprotic phase ends. Right? This is the minimum of the potential. And then the potential becomes unimportant. It turns out that this becomes, then the cosmic evolution is dominated by the kinetic energy of the scalar field. Because the potential becomes unimportant, you get this kinetic phase. The properties of this kinetic phase are also the subject of one of the problems. So at this point, you approach the big crunch. Right? So the scale factor here shrinks slowly, then it shrinks a bit faster, and you get to the big crunch. Okay, this is all the Big Bang, if you want. At this point, you would normally expect radiation and matter to be produced. So in the higher dimensional picture that comes from string theory, we would live on the brain, and this picture corresponds to two brains colliding with each other. So our universe colliding with a second brain. And in such a collision, you expect that you would produce new modes. I mean, you wouldn't expect this collision to be exactly elastic, right? So you produce matter and radiation. In fact, it turns out that this gives the scalar field a little boost so that it comes up to this plateau here. And this is very fast. So this going this way is slow. But then if you get the little bit of extra energy here to go back, then going back this way is extremely fast. So this is just a microphysical scale. This would be on the order of a billion years, and this would be on the order of an atomic time scale or something like that. At this point, the scalar field just gets stuck here because you have Hubble damping due to the radiation produced. And the scalar field just goes up here, and then it gets stuck, almost stuck. Right? And then radiation dominates afterwards. Matter dominates, so you have here the periods of where W is a third, then W equals zero. And then the scalar field starts rolling very slowly back. And this corresponds to the dark energy domination that we just entered recently. So, and then it turns out that if you go back, and the potential at some point starts becoming negative again. As we saw earlier, if the potential starts to go negative, W again rises to a value of larger than plus one. So then you enter the ekprotic phase again. So the idea is that the universe just will keep on expanding for a long time at the moment, but then the cosmological constant will decay. And at first, this field grows extremely slowly because this potential is extremely flat here. But then, of course, it will start rolling faster and faster. And this potential, in this higher dimensional picture where you have two brains colliding, you can think of this phi direction as the distance between the brains. And this corresponds to an attractive force between the brains, drawing them in together. Now, in fact, this is a very simple model with just one scalar field. And this was, in fact, the original model that was proposed. But the picture becomes a bit more complicated if you try and derive this model from string theory. Typically, you have more than one scalar field, and this just becomes a more elaborate thing. So I'm going to talk about that in more detail later. But already here, you can see that the cosmological constant plays an important role in that it stabilizes this whole cycling. So if you come back, but you come back with slightly different energies, it doesn't matter because you just get stuck at a slightly different point. But that makes hardly any difference. It just means that the dark energy phase lasts a little bit longer or a little bit less long. So this is, the dark energy is really some kind of a, like a stabilizing force here. I'm sorry?
Well, I don't know why they wouldn't mind it.
Oh, because like, when you have brains coming to each other in like brain efficient models.
These are not brain and anti-brains.
Oh.
This comes out of Rojava-Witten theory, which is sort of a strong coupling limit of heterotic string theory. And it turns out that these brains are boundaries of space-time. So you consider a theory in higher dimensions, but one of the dimensions is just a line segment. And these brains sit at the ends of this line segment, and they're so-called orbital planes. They're not one is not the anti you know orbital brain of the other. So there is no. I mean, to be fair, nobody has done the calculation of what happens exactly as these brains collide. There have been attempts to do this, to look at this problem classically and semi-classically. And there is, and all these calculations indicate that you get exactly what I said, that the brains, you know, bounce back and with the production of a finite amount of radiation and matter. But nobody has done the calculation of what happens in a full quantum version of this theory. Partly also because the full quantum version doesn't exist at the moment. But I should say that this is the higher dimensional point of view with the brains colliding is, I find it very useful to think about this, but it's not necessary. You can, this model could arise from a completely different kind of physics. You can just take the four-dimensional description with a potential of this type, and you will get the same evolution. I mean, it's useful. I find it useful to think about what happens in the higher dimensional picture, but it's not really an absolute requirement.
I have a more naive question. You said that the field first rolls slowly down the potential, and
yes,
have omega approximately equal to minus one. Then
right,
it speeds up, reaches the bottom, and then goes on the other side.
Yes.
So, but in standard inflationary models, we also have a slow roll phase, then
mm-hmm.
The field speeds up, reaches the bottom, oscillates, and decays. So, why is the reason of, why do we have these two different behaviors? Why doesn't the field oscillate at the bottom of the potential and decay?
Because it has too much kinetic energy. So,
okay,
it has so much kinetic energy that it just rolls over and rolls back up. In inflation, the energy scale is very different. So this scale here corresponds to the bottom of the potential in inflation. So the inflationary potential would have its bottom here, right? And then it would go up. And you have a lot of Hubble damping going down, and it slows the field down. And it just oscillates here. But here, the potential, just, yeah, the scalar field just gets a huge amount of kinetic energy and just flies over this.
Okay.
If you were to stop here, this would be at a negative value. If you were to stop here, this would be like a negative cosmological constant, and it would make the universe collapse. But this doesn't happen here. I mean, you just, in fact, since you roll up from slightly higher than where you end up, you just roll over.
When the two brains are colliding, at this time we have like a Big Bang and Big Crunch.
When the two brains collide, this corresponds to the Big Bang.
Okay,
yes.
You said that phi is, we can identify phi with a distance we can choose when it can.
Oh, I should say e to
so
the phi.
So the Big Crunch should be the phi of the G.
I'm sorry?
You identify phi with a distance between two brains.
Yeah, I mean, right, it should be the distance should be e to the phi in that case. Sorry. Phi goes off to minus infinity as the distance goes to zero. I should have specified this.
Okay.
Yeah. Phi is just a more useful field to consider for this, to work with.
Okay.
Because this has the canonical normalization. But if I look in terms of the higher dimensional interpretation, the distance would be e to the phi.
So phi goes minus infinity, we have also great.
Yes. Yes. So this that would be over here on the left, brain collision. And then we now right now we would be here.
Where would be the time of matter radiation equality on that plot?
That would also be here.
Okay.
So in fact, very quickly after the Big Bang, this evolution back after the Big Bang is extremely fast. And then you just get stuck here, and then radiation comes to dominate. So initially, you're still dominated by this kinetic energy of the scalar field. But this kinetic domination quickly ends because of you get damped. You have a Hubble damping term, which stops you here, and the radiation becomes important, takes over. And then you have radiation matter transition, which is right here, and then also the matter dark energy transition.
I miss the point of why the backward process is so fast.
Because at this brain collision, or at the Big Bang, you get a little, the scalar field picks up a little bit of extra kinetic energy. This is something that also you can see from the calculation of the brain collision. So you have a slight amount of extra kinetic energy going.
Gain energy.
Yes.
Why is that when I think about it, even the last collisions?
Right.
Then you probably lose the energy.
No, that's, yeah. Well, that's the standard intuition. Here, it turns out that you have a positive tension brain and a negative tension brain. And it's the fact that you produce matter also in the negative tension brain that can give you this extra kinetic energy.
So you said this is really brain and anti-brain structure?
No, it's not brain anti-brain.
What
it is, it's positive and negative tension brain, but they're not. Yes.
The negative tension means that is also the same brain. You have some brains that have a negative tension.
Well, it's not the same brain, but it's...
So some kind of different brain?
Well, it...
In
strictly, you have positive and negative tension brain. You also have brains and anti-brains. They're not the same thing.
Okay.
I mean, I guess for a brain, anti-brain, you need all quantum numbers to be...
By negative tension, you mean orientifold plates or something?
These are orbifold planes.
What are negative tension planes? I mean, usually orientifold planes have negative tension in some sense.
But these are not orientifold, they're orbifold.
So they are things, so I think, I see.
Yes.
So how do you get negative tension planes?
Well, in fact, you can see just by, this is a compact direction. So if you have two brains, you need the total charge to be zero.
Yeah.
So you just have charges oppositely distributed.
Charge.
This is Schrödinger-Witten theory, where you just have.
But then the mass is both positive, right? If I'm not wrong. Charges, of course, have to be cancelled. How about the energies? I mean, brains are things in string theory.
Yes.
Right? So they have some energy density, which is usually positive.
Right.
I think tension is based on the mass.
Tension. Yeah, that's why I was asking.
All you need is the mass of the curve. So, then negative mass. We have negative tension.
Yes, gravity behaves differently on the negative tension plane than on the positive tension plane, for example.
No, you cannot.
So, for example,
think of a negative tension plane. Yeah, I agree.
If you look at the standard, if you were to say how. To expand the action terms of the scale factor and how it behaves, the kinetic term for the scale factor and the action would have the opposite sign for the negative tension brain. So gravity has strange properties on the negative tension brain.
Two
right. Oh, sorry. These are all the folds, yes. They're endpoints of space-time. They are. I'm going to talk about this in detail.
That's
in the fourth lecture. But you just, in a sense, you have a line segment, but you can, if you have a line segment, you can think of it as having a circle, but you identify points that are these points, and then you have two fixed points. And these are the points where the orbital planes reside. So in fact, it's not right. The definition of an orbital, I think, is that you have a manifold, but you divide out by a group, discrete group. And here you can write this as a circle divided by this two symmetry. Yes.
Does each cycle here generate more and more matter and radiation? Like every subsequent cycle would it generate
each cycle generates more matter and radiation. But during each phase of dark energy domination, the universe expands by a huge amount. And during the contracting phase, the scale factor only shrinks by a very small amount. So in fact, you dilute everything. During each cycle, you dilute everything by an enormous amount. Then you produce new matter and radiation again, but again, over the course of the whole cycle, it gets diluted. So in that sense, you always go back to the same density of radiation and matter at each cycle. The densities are cyclic, but the total amounts keep increasing. But the total amounts, we cannot measure them anyway. This is all far outside of our horizon. We don't care about it. It's the density that's the important thing. Okay, so that's it for the first lecture. Thank you.